This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hello and welcome to Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd with me, Hannah Crosby. We're delighted to be recording our second series right here in our historic home in St. James's. Together, we'll be uncorking and discussing the wines our experts have pilled from their own collections, each from a wine region you may not have discovered, but undoubtedly deserves to be on your radar. In this week's episode, we'll be exploring the multifaceted world of German wine. Now, because a bit of knowledge is needed to decipher their wine labels and understand their styles, German wines are something of an insider's secret. But today, I'm joined by buyer Rob Whitehead and Barbara Drew MW. Over a bottle of 2012 Schlossberg by Eva Fricker, we'll explore why German wine is undoubtedly worth the extra effort. Rob, Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today to discuss why we should all be collecting German wine. Rob, we know that you are evangelical about German wine, but your day-to-day role with Berry Brothers and Rudd is quite different, right?
That's right. I am the spirits buyer, so my job is to drink things that have been distilled to usually 40% alcohol or more, that are normally absolutely full of intensity and flavour. And, you know, there is almost nothing further in the drinks world from the elegance and poise and grace of brilliant German Riesling than cask strength single malt whiskey or still strength mezcal or something in my day to day. And that's possibly why I'm so obsessed with Riesling. spirits are my morning, noon and night.
Yeah.
But just the odd moment in between those times is Riesling.
And just to talk a little bit about the beautiful room we're recording in. So we're recording the second series from our historic home in St. James's. So if you hear any bells ringing or people talking, we're just moments away from the shop floor. This room we're recording in, though, the spirits room, has a special importance to you, as well as an intriguing history. The wall behind us where we're sitting, I think, has a bit of history too as well, right?
That's right. So this wall predates us, which is a remarkable thought. This wall is Tudor. It was built about 1530, and it's the wall of King Henry VIII's tennis court. So where we are sitting half a millennium ago, the King of England was playing tennis.
Wonderful. Well, Barbara, let's move on to you. Not only are you a master of wine, you've also been at Berry Brothers and Rudd for over a decade, is that right?
That is absolutely right. Not nearly as long as Rob here, but still long enough to really start to appreciate some of the immense history that we're surrounded by here. And of course, some of the brilliant bottles of wine.
It's fair to say that it's not always immediately obvious what role German wine has to play in a fine wine collection. But the first wine you think you ever drank was actually German. Could you tell me a bit more about that?
Almost certainly, yeah. I grew up in a household where wine wasn't a thing. I'm from Scarborough, and my working class background precluded wine being a thing. My dad drank beer. There was a bottle of port in the cupboard, which was used on Christmas Day. There was a bottle of sherry in the cupboard, which was mainly medicinal. There was a bottle of whiskey, which I don't think ever got used for anything. And there was a bottle of rum, because very occasionally my mum would have a rum and pep. Well, apparently rum and peppermint was her drink of choice through the questionable 60s, 70s and 80s. Anyway, my childhood, therefore, did not include wine. And then somebody, I suspect a rather silver-tongued travelling salesman, persuaded my parents to take a wine subscription. So every 3 months, they got a case of mixed wine delivered. This was a German wine company, so all the wine was German. And it included Sekt, sparkling wine. It included mainly whites and occasionally some red. But the only one I ever came across either came in a very tall bottle, a long neck, or in a squat round bottle, a box bottle, the Franken star. And I still, my mum has one bottle left. I've told her never to open it, of 1991 super cheap Franken Müller Thurgau. It is not probably in the best of condition. One day I might open it, we'll see.
Well, we'll come back to your love of Riesling a bit later. Barbara, people are often confused by German wine labels and German wines in general, but they have a cult following amongst collectors and sommeliers. Why do you think this is?
So for me, I think that Riesling it really is a nerd grape. And the reason I say that is it can be a little bit tricky to understand at first, but there's so much excitement, so many fantastic flavours, so many wonderful producers. It's excellent, excellent value. And crucially for me, this wine, this grape variety, it's all about a fantastic tension between sweetness, between fruit, between acidity. That balance is crucial. Mm. When it's off, when the balance isn't there, these wines are hard work. You get lots of acidity without the flavour to support it. But when it's done properly, they are truly exquisite.
Rob, we actually challenged you to bring along just one bottle to help us better understand everything great about German wine and Riesling. We've got it right in front of us. What exactly are we going to be drinking?
So this is a bottle of 2012 Lorca Schlossberg. This is Eva's top wine. She has two wines that are sort of, it's not really a Grand Cru classification, but they mm-hmm. would be classified as Grand Cru if there was such a thing. This is a wine that I bought on release and put into my reserves at BBR. Mm-hmm. I wanted it to be stored perfectly, and at the time, my little flat in Oval where I lived did not have proper wine storage.
No, really?
So, put it into storage at BBR, and I withdrew my first bottle from that case this last Christmas, so 6 months ago, give or take, and thoroughly enjoyed it, so I thought I would bring it along. 2012's a really nice vintage. It's not an exceptional vintage. It's not a 10 out of 10 vintage. It's not a one that will be written up when we look back in the decades to come as one of the truly great vintages, like 7 or a 1. But
it does hold a special importance to you.
It's the year I got married, which helps. So these grapes were ripening whilst I was saying my vows. And it's a wonderful wine, therefore, to share with my wife, which is what I did at Christmas. But I thought I could bring a bottle along to share with you lovely people too.
Oh, thank you so
Thanks,
much.
Thanks, Rob.
Right, shall we crack it open? How's it smelling?
Not corked.
Brilliant. So, initial thoughts, how are we feeling about this wine?
Yeah, it's an absolute delight. I mean, holding any wine for a period of time, a decade, half a decade, 3 decades, doesn't matter. Holding any wine, when you open it, there is always a moment of trepidation because it could be faulty. That can happen. Wine's a product to which that can happen. But it's possible. Having had a bottle a few months ago, this is absolutely in exactly the same place as that. Mm-hmm. One wouldn't expect a huge amount of change in a few months after a decade. I am thrilled I still have the rest of the case because the rest of it is not going to get opened anytime soon. I think there's more time to come.
Oh, it's absolutely remarkable. Thank you so much for sharing this with us, Barbara. What are your thoughts?
Really, really beautiful wine. I love the fact that this is 10 years old. And yet, there's clearly so much more excitement to come in those remaining 10 bottles. To give the listeners a little idea of what we can smell and taste here, there's wonderful waxy aromas on the nose. There's honey, beeswax, something a little bit nutty as well, but also lots of fresh fruit character still. Lots of lime pith, lots of grapefruit, really characteristic of German Riesling. And when you taste it, there's initially a sense of a little bit of sweetness coming through from the fruit. And then instantly it jumps over into that mouth-watering acidity that really is the hallmark of excellent, excellent Riesling. The best thing for me there is those flavours continue to evolve on the finish. I took a sip of this about 2 minutes ago now, and I can still taste those flavours evolving and changing on the finish, and that is really one of the key aspects of an excellent, excellent quality wine.
Yeah, that's right. Eva didn't have any preordained ideal as to how dry this wine was. This wine is not bone dry. It's by no means sweet, but Barbara's absolutely right. That little touch of sweetness just sets everything off on the palate. It's like the starting gun just firing off, and everything then races off from there. The acidity is beautiful. The limey, grapefruity stuff is gorgeous. And something getting very close to menthol, minty, eucalypt, something just hovering near that around the edges of the mouth just keeps it lively. Mm. And it's just jaw-droppingly well-balanced.
Yeah.
There is nothing out of kilter. It is a spherical object. How a wine that comes in a long neck bottle can be a spherical object, how a liquid can ever be truly spherical, I've no idea. But the picture in my brain of tasting it is totally, totally spherical, no rough edges. If you taste something and it has something sticking out, if there's an array of wonderful flavours, but one of them sticks out, even if it's your favourite flavour in the world, eventually you get bored of it. Mm-hmm. It might be after one sip or 100, but to create something where it is totally coherent, to create something where it is all of a piece, to create something where it's the sum is infinitely greater than the parts, that takes immense talent, real very hard work on these slopey vineyards, and a little bit of luck thanks to the weather. We can't control that bit.
So it's very obvious that you two are massive fans of Eva Fricka, the producer of the wine that we're tasting today. Barbara, am I right in thinking that you actually met her at a summer party?
Yes. So I believe it was perhaps 4 or 5 years ago now. And we had some of our producers over for an event. Eva Fricka herself is an absolute delight. I would go so far as to say she is a complete rock star. Now, I will not say that you have to be a delightful person to make exquisite wine, but in my experience, the two tend to go together. And she's one of my favourite producers, not just for the wines, but she's so much fun, so lively, so generous with her time. Really, really wonderful person.
And Rob, you said that she actually came into the shop while you were working there, right?
Oh, that's right, yeah. She came in a number of times. One of the great joys of working in this remarkable old establishment just on the shop floor was meeting pretty much every great wine and spirits maker that lives. I've chatted with them all at one time or another to some extent. So yeah, I met Eva a couple of times. The very first time was notable. I was in this room selling spirits, doing my job, and it was the first time and probably the only time that I have properly fangirled. I think it's the only time where I have seen someone walk in the front door of the shop and made an absolute beeline for the cellars and hid because of being starstruck. Mm-hmm. I have served rock stars and film stars. I have served acting prime ministers and royalty. I have shaken hands and chatted with the greatest wine and spirit makers. Once, a tiny elfin German woman has reduced me to running away and hiding until she's gone because she's too good at making wine.
Mm. Oh my goodness. Well, we've already spoken about how much you love that she simplifies the usually difficult to decipher German labels. But Barbara, could you offer any expert advice or tips on what we should be looking for when we're trying to translate the usual kind of German wine labels?
So I think when many people start exploring German wine, they quickly become overwhelmed by just the huge complexity of vocabulary. There are various different classification systems. The most notable one considers sweetness levels in the wine, or roughly sweetness levels in the wine. It's a little more complex than that. Of course, it's wine. But for example, you will have words like cabinet or Spätlese on the label of the wine, indicating that there might be some sugar in the wine, all the way through to wonderful German words like Trockenbier and Auslese, suggesting that this is a wine which is incredibly sweet. However, what I would say is that the region that you're sourcing your German wine from will have a far greater impact on the style of the wine than necessarily these terms. So traditionally, we've often looked at wines from the Mosel Valley, and this is where you tend to get a lot of those sweeter styles, a lot of those really sweet styles. Eva Fricka's wine comes from the Rheingau, and actually, usually because of the climate there, Rheingau wines will be a little less sweet. They might have a tiny hint of sugar just to get that perfect balance, but you're far less likely to have this array of confusing styles, which are somewhere between not quite completely dry and not pudding wine. Mm-hmm. Those wines where you're really not sure what on earth to do with them.
The sweetness in this wine is just a cushion. Mm. It's just a lovely fabric-y cushion for all the flavours to sit on. Mm. There's no sense of stickiness. There's no cloying anything. It's masterful. It really is.
And I feel that sometimes we shy away from sweetness in wine. We think, oh gosh, if there's any sugar at all, it must be a dessert wine. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's simply not true. Sometimes sugar can just help to enhance some of the other flavors. Mm-hmm. If you think about cooking, you'll occasionally add a pinch of sugar to your tomato sauce to bring out the flavors. You wouldn't say, I'm now going to serve that as a dessert.
Yeah.
And it's simply there to enhance everything else. So mm-hmm. in the best German wines, for me, that's what the sugar does. It's far, far less about this must go with a tart tatin, and it's more about ensuring that all of the flavours and the acidity really zing.
Mm. Yeah, it's so important. And usually when we talk about sweetness in German wine, we're talking about Riesling. But would you say there are any other noteworthy German wines that we should be looking out for?
There are many wonderful German wines. Mm-hmm. And in fact, you know, Germany produces the entire range. Rob, you've already mentioned the beautiful sparkling wines, Sekt, that tends to get overlooked in favour of champagne or English sparkling wine, and some gorgeous white wines. One of my favourite grapes, particularly esoteric, which is called Schorlieb. It's got this brilliant grapefruit kind of tangy flavour, does gorgeous sweet wines as well as dry wines. In fact, Germany produces a huge amount of Pinot Noir,
really?
Or Spätburgunder, as it's known locally. And some of the most delicious Pinot Noirs that I've tasted have come from Germany, from the Pfalz and Baden in particular.
Yeah, there's a tiny, tiny little wine region called the Ahr, A-H-R, which just offshoots off the Rhine, where Pinot is their speciality. Is the by miles the coldest, most northerly red wine region, proper red wine region in Europe. Mm-hmm. But it has this astonishingly tiny little microclimate as the river just zigzags back on itself, mm-hmm. like some sort of weird frothing snake. And they can grow Pinot, beautiful Pinots, absolutely gorgeous wines. Mm-hmm. There's very little of them because the valley is tiny,
yeah.
The vineyards are precipitous. But find them. They're brilliant. They're absolutely brilliant.
Yeah. Well, it's clear there's so much to choose from, but there's no doubt that interest in general in German wine has shot up as of late. But Barbara, the cellars that lie beneath us actually reveal a fondness for German wine that goes far beyond recent history. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Absolutely. I think if we look back at the history of German wine, they get as far back as the 60s and 70s. Mm-hmm. They start thinking about, I probably shouldn't mention brand names, but fond favourites you may recall from your childhood in tall blue or green or brown bottles, with perhaps too much sugar, not enough complexity. But if we head back much further to the late 17 and mid 1800s, Riesling was one of the noble wines of the day. And in fact, our cellars will have been filled with a wine called Hock. Now, today we think of Hock as shorthand for wine that you might not want to serve your guests.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, it's named after the village of Hockheim in the Rheingau. And Queen Victoria visited there in 1850, and she really started a flurry of excitement about these wines. They became more expensive than the Bordeaux or the Burgundy wines of the day, and our customers would have been coming in asking us for our very best hock for their dinners in the evening.
So it's actually really interesting that you mentioned that, because Rob, you've actually brought in something quite special. So for our listeners, we are currently looking at little tiny price lists dating from 1910, and apparently they reveal something quite similar. So Rob, can you tell us a bit about what you're looking at the moment?
Absolutely right. So I mean, tastes of wine change, availability of wine changes. That is a thing. We live in a world today where we can get almost anything from almost anywhere. It's a fabulous and extraordinary bounty that we have. In 1910, there were only 17 pages in the Barry Brothers and Red price list, of which I'll sadly note that there was only three single malt whiskies, but
moving on.
With German wines, they were split into Hock and Moselle, so Hock from the Rhine and Moselle from the Moselle. And this shows that the 1893 Schloss Johannesburg Cabernet, so the sort of the standard wine of the estate, was 200 shillings per dozen, which is exactly the same price as Romani Conti 1888.
Wow.
And twice the price of Chateau de Chem 1893.
Wow.
There's also an awful lot more Lafite than there is Schloss Johannesburg, or Romney Conti for that matter, which is also a small estate.
I mean, Schloss Johannesburg is one of the iconic vineyards in the Rheingau.
In the world.
Quite correct.
Thank you.
There has been a vineyard on this site since at least 800 AD, although there's archaeological evidence that the Romans were planting there. And in the 1700s, it really sparked the craze for Riesling, far ahead of where the Mosel is, which is perhaps what we associate with Riesling these days. And the Rheingau is a beautiful region, but it's very, very small. It's a 20-mile stretch of river.
It's very underrated as well, you were saying.
Absolutely. I think that perhaps people aren't so familiar with it, potentially because it's quite small. Mm-hmm. You've just got 20 miles where the river is running east to west. You've got these beautiful south-facing slopes that mean the grapes can ripen perfectly. And then the river's off. It's running north again, and you've missed that opportunity. So just 20 miles to produce some of the greatest wines of the world. Mm. It's pretty awe-inspiring, I personally think. You realise these amazing regions are so small.
They really are, and the easiest way to see that particular region is to take a boat through the middle of it. I mean, there's a river. It couldn't be more... It's absolutely in the middle because the vineyards are on either side of the river. The south-facing ones being the very fated ones, but there are vineyards on the other side as well. And the river, it never, ever stays still. It is constantly back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. So it's endlessly changing both soil type and...
Aspect.
Thank you, MW. Mm-hmm. So you're seeing this change. If you take a boat along either the Mosel or more the Rhine, you can sit in what is often lovely sunshine, drinking fabulous Riesling and just watching these jaw-dropping vineyards pass by, nestled around little beautiful villages, often overlooked by ruined castles. It is obscenely beautiful.
Mm. Well, let's talk a bit more about collecting Riesling these days. Vintage variation is something of importance to many, many fine wine regions, not to mention collectors. But Barbara, do vintage conditions matter to German wines to the same extent as, say, Bordeaux or Burgundy?
They absolutely do. Vintage conditions are particularly important where you're growing a grape at the very edge of its ripening zone. Mm-hmm. So if a grape is absolutely happy right in the middle of where it can comfortably ripen, you've got a bit of wiggle room either side. If your year is either too hot or too cool, your grape will still ripen comfortably. When it's at the very limit, though, of where those grapes will ripen, a year that's a little bit cooler is really going to affect the quality of the grapes. It's really going to affect the flavour of the wine. So you certainly will get different flavour profiles. You'll get different balance in these wines depending on the characteristics of the year. If it was warmer, you might have slightly softer acidity. You might have a little bit less sugar left in the wine to balance that out. For cooler years, you're going to get far more of those slaty, sort of lime pith aromas coming through. You might need to leave just a touch more sugar to balance out that sort of sharper acidity. For those who are really getting into this area, I think it's quite fun to try different vintages side by side and see the differences in the different flavour profiles. But I do appreciate it. Another element in the sometimes confusing puzzle that is wine.
Mm. So is it a case of good or bad vintages, or is it just a case of different vintages?
These days, and to be honest, I think this is true in any wine region of the world, winemakers now know enough about how to look after their vineyards and how to make their wine that the real difference in vintages is simply flavour profile and to some extent how long the wines will age. Mm-hmm. These days, I think if you're making a bad wine, you are actively choosing to do so.
You heard it here first. So you just touched a little bit on aging potential there. Just what kind of aging potential can we expect from German wine?
So the wonderful thing about Riesling is it has incredibly high acidity. It can have lots of sugar, and both of those things are great preservatives. And it tends to have a huge amount of complex flavours as well. Those three things can contribute to brilliant aging potential. Now, that doesn't mean that a Riesling that you've bought for an extraordinarily inexpensive amount from your local non-specialist wine shop will necessarily age for 50 years. However, I've been fortunate enough to taste Rieslings from the late 1800s, and these are white wines which really can age phenomenally well. Even those middle-tier wines from good producers will happily keep for 40 to 50 years, which is incredibly rare for a white wine.
Yeah.
Even excellent white Burgundy, there are only a handful of producers and vineyards that will keep that long.
They'll cost quite a bit more than these beautiful Rieslings. The very greatest Rieslings will cost today a fraction of the greatest other wines of the world, but their longevity is equal to it, and their reliability with regard to that longevity is possibly even greater than the great Burgundies, the great Clarets, the many other wonderful wines that exist. Even entry-level wines from good producers can last a decade. And not just last a decade, that's almost pejorative. They can evolve over that decade. They flourish. Can improve and brilliant. They can flourish. They can give you more through that time. An array of wines from 2012, my wedding year, and from 2016, the year my daughter was born. And the likelihood of me being able to drink those 2016s with my daughter is almost 100%. They will be brilliant by the time she is brilliant enough to drink them with me.
So for people who are looking to actually open Riesling that they might already have in their cellars, what dishes would you suggest to pair with it? Rob, start with you.
It's almost a better answer to say what dishes wouldn't or haven't I paired with it. Anything with really, really, really dense, heavy protein might be too much. Okay. You know, big oxtail stew, you know, a haunch of venison, those kind of things might be a bit much. Personally, I might do it. But any pork dish of any kind, any poultry dish of any kind, any fish dish of any kind, any dish with light to moderate spice levels, and that's spice in the traditional old cinnamon, nutmeg, macey way or the moderny chili-y way, they all work. If the Riesling is... That's all for dry and kind of off-dry styles. Mm. Any of that works. Likewise, when you're into dessert territory, if it's a really, really gooey, heavy, you know, pecan pie thing, that, again, might be a bit much. But if the dessert is made of fruit, drink Riesling, people. Mm-hmm. It works because it has the acidity and the balance to work with it. It's an extraordinarily versatile wine. Mm. And, of course, a glass before goes well as well. It benefits from food like a lot of great wines, but it can be a little bit more forgiving of that pre-prandial glass than some other wines do.
Barbara, how about you? Would you echo that?
Absolutely. I think, Rob, your point about the acidity is crucial. So I would come at this from a structure point of view. And by that, I mean, what are the characteristics of the wine that make it suitable for pairing with food? And what you have is high acidity, it makes your mouth water, it cuts through fat and means that the wine can go with almost anything. And you have a density, often of fruit flavour, occasionally allied to some sweetness as well, which again will go with pretty much anything. All of those difficult dishes that can prove tricky to pair with wines. Things like pickles, where you've got a bit of sweetness and a bit of acidity. Riesling, perfect match. Things like barbecue food. Mm. Might sound strange, but you often have a bit of sweetness there with your sauces. That can really clash with some wines. Riesling, perfect match.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Anything that's got that lovely spice character, as you said. Anything even that's got a bit of fruit in it. Salads with perhaps some strawberries or some peaches, anything a bit sweeter that might cause problems with other wines. Riesling, perfect match. Don't say that you should only pair it with difficult foods. It can go with, you know, delicious classic dishes as well. But if in doubt, you're not quite sure what to go, Riesling will almost certainly be really, really beautiful.
Riesling rescues you. Rescued me.
Is that the new tagline? Wines of Germany, Riesling rescues you.
Yeah, go on then.
Perfect.
I'll take a fee. Let's do that.
So, Rob, we've talked at length about your love for Eva Fricka, but are there any other producers that collectors or just enthusiasts should keep their eyes out for?
Many is the short, trite answer. The wines of Prum are fated and renowned as being well worth squirreling away in the cellar. But realistically, if you are buying really really interesting, good quality German wine from a merchant that knows their onions, it's going to be worth collecting. It's going to be worth being part of your repertoire instead of just pouring the same old, same old. So we've worked with many, as these old price lists show, many German wine producers over the decades, even my decade and a half at BBR, and watching the wines develop, watching the producers develop. You know, Eva Fricker started in 2006. By 2012, she was just really getting into her stride. Mm-hmm. The stuff she's making now, crikey. I'm excited to be in my late 40s one day. So it is, there's a whole host of great producers, but talk to your trusted wine merchant. Talk to the person who you feel is going to be able to advise you to round out that cellar. Don't do what I've done, possibly, because my cellar is overwhelmingly, just obliteratingly overwhelmingly German. It is at least 90% Riesling, which is not a balanced and sensible way to build a cellar, unless you're me, and I am me. But the... talk to your wine spirit merchant.
Mm-hmm. And how about you, Barbara? Are there any other producers we should be keeping an eye out for?
So I would say that the most important piece of information to answer this question mm-hmm. is your personal taste and preference when it comes yes. to wine. Rob has already mentioned the wines of Prüm. Magnificent wines, they tend to be perhaps a little bit more mineral. So slightly more of those flinty aromas, slightly more of those chalky character compared with Eva Fricker's wines, which often have a beautiful floral or fruity note. Mm-hmm. There's also the wines of, I'm a particular fan of Helmut and Cornelius Donhoff from the Naha. They tend to have a gorgeous richness to them. Lots of more orchard fruit, peach, tropical fruit coming through.
It's a little bit warmer down there, isn't it?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And the wines of Egon Müller as well, absolutely fantastic, and they age incredibly well. Mm-hmm. But style is important. It might be that you pick up a Riesling, you age it for 20 years and discover it's not actually evolving in the way that you want. And for Riesling in particular, this is important because it reflects where it's grown so precisely mm-hmm. that you will get an incredible array of flavours and aromas coming through in these wines, mm-hmm. far more than you might in Sauvignon Blanc or Chardonnay or even Cabernet Sauvignon. And so figuring out which Riesling flavour profile is the one that you particularly like, that will help you to narrow down on the producers that you should be buying.
Yeah, those vineyard sites, as you say, are really important. This is Eva's top wine, in inverted commas, her Grand Cru. My favourite isn't the top one, it's the one down. She has a wine that I would consider a premier Cru, Lorkhauser mm-hmm. Seligmacher, which I've also got a case of, but I'm not sharing with you people.
In fact, we're talking about how fantastically these wines age, but they are also delicious young. And I'll be honest, my go-to Thursday night wine, Friday night wine, Saturday lunchtime wine perhaps at home is our Berry Brothers and Rudd own selection Riesling. That's made for us by Selbach Oster. Delicious wine. It's a cabinet, and all that means is there's a bit of sugar in there, not too much, just enough to offset the brilliant acidity. It's definitely more on the fruity and floral end of the spectrum. Incredibly light as well. 9.5% alcohol. Very refreshing. So that's an excellent place to start to benchmark, and then you can go from there and figure out whether you want something a bit more fruity, a bit more stony, a bit more acidic, or 50 years older.
That's right. It's a brilliant little wine, and does show as well over the many years vintage variation. If you get a really, really good vintage of our house Mosel Riesling, it embarrasses things at two or three times the price.
Really?
That are more fated, perhaps. Mm. It's perfectly good in lesser years too, so it's a lovely wine. When you get a really good year of it, oh, it's fabulous. Strangely, I served it at my wedding. How surprising.
So just to round things up, Rob, if I had to press you for one thing that is the most enthralling thing about German wine, what would that be?
It's its versatility. It isn't just the one thing that for a long time it's been considered to be. I can and do drink German wine at every point during any given meal, except the very, very heaviest, dishes. So use it as you would any great wine. Mm-hmm. It can work for a lot of palates. I've switched on a lot of people to really interesting wine via Riesling. Mm-hmm. People that are just beginning their journey into wine, that enjoy nice wine, but haven't yet experienced something that's that little bit different to make them go, aha, there's something to this, actually quite a good way is Riesling, because they don't expect it to do it.
It's a gateway wine.
It is a gateway wine, yeah. It's absolutely one of those, oh yes.
And Barbara, could you possibly give listeners one reason why they should take the time to understand and enjoy the world of German wine?
This is a wine that will outlast you if you let it. It's a wine that really is an investment in your future drinking pleasure, even in your children's future drinking pleasure. There are very, very few wines that can age as long as excellent Riesling. And I think that's part of the magic of wine. You're tasting something that somebody made 50 years ago, that perhaps one of your forebears laid down for you. I think that's really, really special.
Well, all that remains for me to say is, Rob, Barbara, thank you so much for taking the time to come and sit with me in this beautiful room to discuss the pleasures of German wine.
Thanks, Rob, for this delicious Riesling.
No, thank you so much, Rob. This has been an absolute pleasure.
Cheers, you're welcome.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Drinking Well, a podcast by Berry Brothers and Rudd. If you'd like to browse the producers mentioned in today's podcast and see what wines we have available, visit bbr.com/podcast. Or if you're interested in starting your fine wine collection with Berry Brothers and Rudd, all the information you need can be found on bbr.com/collecting. Now, if you've enjoyed this episode or you've been enjoying the podcast in general, do leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. We hope to welcome you back soon, but until then, thank you again for listening to this episode of Drinking Well.